like, okay? VOA won the hits. Take a look inside.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak. This program is designed for English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
On today's program, we tell you how one European country is close to becoming smoke-free. Later, Dan Friedel and Katie Weaver present a special edition education report. We close with the next part of our U.S. history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, Sweden is getting close to becoming the first smoke-free country in the European Union. The country of 10.5 million people has had the lowest percentage of smokers in the EU for many years. A country is smoke-free if less than 5% of the population smokes daily. Only 6.4% of Swedes over the age of 15 were daily smokers in 2019. That was the lowest percentage in the EU. The Eurostat Statistics Agency says that across the 27 countries of the EU, the average was 18.5%. Data from the Public Health Agency of Sweden show that the smoking rate has continued to fall, reaching 5.6% last year. "We like a healthy way to live. I think that's the reason," said Karina Asterson, who lives in Stockholm. "Smoking never interested her," she added, "because I don't like the smell. I want to take care of my body." Sweden says its anti-smoking actions improve health in several ways, including a lower rate of lung cancer. Ulrika Arehed is Secretary General of the Swedish Cancer Society. She said Sweden was early to limit smoking in public places, such as school playgrounds. Later, the country added smoking bans for outdoor restaurants and bus stations. The country also increased taxes on cigarettes and changed rules on how they can be sold. However, other forms of tobacco remain popular in Sweden. Snus is a wet tobacco powder placed in the mouth next to the teeth. Snus makers say their products help reduce cigarette smoking. But health officials say snus is another product that makes people addicted to nicotine, the main drug in tobacco. Snus is such a popular part of Swedish culture that the country demanded an exemption to the EU's ban on smokeless tobacco when it joined the EU in 1995. Patrick Hildingsson is a spokesman for Swedish Match, Sweden's top snus maker. He said officials should urge the tobacco industry to develop less harmful choices to smoking, such as snus and e-cigarettes. If snus and similar products are included, the World Health Organization notes that more than 20% of adults in Sweden use tobacco. This brings Sweden close to the world average. The WHO marked World No Tobacco Day on Wednesday.
American colleges and universities are expecting an important decision from the U.S. Supreme Court involving a policy called affirmative action. The decision will come by the end of June. Affirmative action generally describes the idea that it is good for society to favor people who come from groups thought to be disadvantaged or discriminated against. Colleges and employers often think about affirmative action issues when making decisions. College and university officials started considering race a lot in the 1960s and 1970s. They wanted the racial and ethnic backgrounds of students at the schools where they worked to match those of America's high school students. Last year, the nation's highest court agreed to hear the appeal by a group called Students for Fair Admissions, SFFA, against Harvard University and the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. The group accused the universities of discriminating against applicants based on race in violation of federal law or the U.S. Constitution. Legal experts believe the Supreme Court will say colleges and universities can no longer consider race when choosing students. The Supreme Court first ruled in 1978 that race could be considered in college admission. But in the same case, it banned setting aside a percentage or number of students for admission based on race alone. In 2003, the court again permitted race to be considered to create a diverse educational environment. In 1998, voters in California approved a measure barring public colleges and universities from considering race in admitting students. In 2020, a University of California, Berkeley doctoral student released a paper that found a drop in the number of Black, Hispanic, and Native American students who were accepted to the University of California, Los Angeles, UCLA, and Berkeley. A UCLA law professor disputed those findings. However, Californians again voted to approve the ban in 2020.
Some American universities believe an important part of the educational experience includes meeting and going to class with a diverse group of people. So those who work on college admissions are thinking of ways to keep their student body diverse without asking students' skin color or family backgrounds. Seth Allen is the head of admissions at Pomona College in California. He said, "We cannot afford, as a nation, to go back on our goals to create an educated and equitable society." He said, "Universities need to work together to be sure they are not furthering the enrollment gap among different groups of students. Schools are thinking of ways to advertise themselves to minority groups. They have made applications less costly for families who do not have much money. And they have promised to make stronger connections with high schools and community colleges that have mostly minority students. At Rice University in Houston, Texas, school leaders want to think more about the writing examples that students send in with their application. They believe paying more attention to the written answers will help them choose a diverse group of students." The president at Skidmore College in New York State said the school will make good connections with high school counselors. Those counselors will then advise students to apply. Universities are already making it easier for students to apply. Many schools will consider students who do not send scores from tests, such as the SAT or ACT. They are also trying to increase financial awards for students who might not usually consider a costly university. The school leaders who talked with the Reuters news agency said they expect the Supreme Court's decision to prompt appeals and new legal cases. Danielle Holly is a legal expert who is currently the head of the law school at Howard University in Washington, D.C. Later this year, she will start as the president of Mount Holyoke University in Massachusetts. Holly said the court's decision will start a whole new generation of lawsuits.
Yvonne Beruman is vice president of admissions at Pitzer College in California. She said her group may invite students who do not normally think of Pitzer to an essay workshop with the hopes of getting them to apply. Kent Devereaux is president of Goucher College in Maryland. He said organizations in low-income communities who identify students who could do well in college are going to be more important than before. We're seeing each year a bigger percentage of our students come from those organizations, Devereaux said. Even military schools, such as the U.S. Air Force Academy, are getting ready for the Supreme Court's decision. Colonel Arthur Primus Jr. is the Academy's admissions director. Primus said, "The plan is to visit schools in parts of the U.S. with a lot of minority students and ask them to apply. Students need to ask their local member of Congress for a nomination if they want to go to the Air Force Academy." Primus said the Academy has a long tradition of actively recruiting diverse candidates, but we're going to have to be really expansive. I'm Dan Friedel.
And I'm Katie Weaver.
We are joined now by Dan Friedel. He looked at what colleges and universities are planning in case the U.S. Supreme Court decides schools are not permitted to think about race when making admissions offers to students. Thanks for joining us, Dan.
You're welcome, Ashley. Happy to be here.
The experts believe the Supreme Court is going to tell colleges and universities they cannot use race to diversify their student body. Why is this worrisome for those in higher education?
Ashley, many universities believe students learn a little bit more by being on campus with people of different races, ethnicities, and family backgrounds. They think learning happens not just from books and classroom discussions, but also, for example, by interacting with different people in school, eating, or living spaces.
Right. So how do universities plan to make sure they have different kinds of people at their school?
Well, if schools cannot ask their students about their race or family backgrounds, they hope to increase the number of applicants with different backgrounds. That way, if they choose the best students based on grades, writing examples, or tests, they will still get a diverse group of students. So they're trying to make stronger connections with high school counselors and organizations in minority communities who can point out good students.
Well, thanks for taking the time to talk with me today, Dan.
You're welcome, Ashley. Glad to join you and our listeners.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. Today we tell about life in the United States during the 1960s. The 1960s began with the election of the first president born in the 20th century, John Kennedy. For many Americans, the young president represented a spirit of hope for the nation. When Kennedy was murdered in 1963, many felt that their hopes died too. This was especially true of young people and members and supporters of minority groups. A time of innocence and hope soon began to look like a time of anger and violence. Many Americans protested to demand an end to the unfair treatment of black citizens. Many more protested to demand an end to the war in Vietnam. And many protested to demand full equality for women. By the middle of the 1960s, it had become almost impossible for President Lyndon Johnson to leave the White House without facing protesters against the war in Vietnam. In March of 1968, Johnson announced that he would not seek another term in office. In addition to President Kennedy, two other influential Americans were murdered during the 1960s. Civil rights leader Martin Luther King Jr. was shot in Memphis, Tennessee in 1968. Several weeks later, Robert Kennedy, John Kennedy's brother, was shot in Los Angeles, California. He was campaigning to win his party's nomination for president. The two murders resulted in riots in cities across the country. The unrest and violence affected many young Americans. The effect seemed especially bad because of the time in which they had grown up. By the middle 1950s, most of their parents had jobs that paid well. They expressed satisfaction with their lives. They taught their children what were called middle-class values. These included a belief in God, hard work, and service to their country. Later, many young Americans began to question these beliefs. They felt that their parents' values were not enough to help them deal with the social and racial difficulties of the 1960s. They rebelled by letting their hair grow long and by wearing unusual clothing. Their dissatisfaction was strongly expressed in music. Rock and roll music had become very popular in America in the 1950s. Some people, however, did not approve of it. They thought it was too sexual. These people disliked the rock and roll of the 1960s even more. They found the words especially unpleasant. The musicians themselves thought the words were extremely important. As singer and songwriter Bob Dylan said, "There would be no music without the words." Bob Dylan produced many songs of social protest. He wrote anti-war songs before the war in Vietnam became a violent issue in the United States. One was called Blowin' in the Wind.
How many roads? words must a man walk down before you call him a man? How many seas must the white dove sail before she sleeps in the sand? Yes, and how many times must the cannonballs fly before they're forever banned? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind.
In addition to songs of social protest, rock and roll music continued to be popular in America during the 1960s. The most popular group, however, was not American, it was British, the Beatles, four rock and roll musicians from Liverpool. The Beatles' song, I Want to Hold Your Hand, went on sale in the United States at the end of 1963. Within 5 weeks, it was the biggest selling record in the country. Other songs, including some by the Beatles, sounded more revolutionary. They spoke about drugs and sex, although not always openly.
Picture yourself in a boat on a river with tangerine trees and marmalade skies.
In the 1960s, do your own thing became a common expression. It meant to do whatever you wanted without feeling guilty. 500,000 young Americans did their own thing at the Woodstock Music Festival in 1969. They gathered at a farm in New York State. They listened to musicians such as Jimi Hendrix and Joan Baez, and to groups like The Who and Jefferson Airplane.
Look what's happening on the street, got a revolution.
Got a revolution.
Hey, I'm dancing down the street, got a revolution.
Got a revolution.
Hey, been waving on the people I meet,
got a revolution.
Woodstock became a symbol of the young people's rebellion against traditional values. Many young people called themselves hippies. Hippies believed there should be more love and personal freedom in America. In 1967, poet Allen Ginsberg helped lead a gathering of hippies in San Francisco. No one knows exactly how many people considered themselves hippies, but 20,000 attended the gathering. Another leader of the event was Timothy Leary.
Now, energy comes.
He was a former university professor and researcher. Leary urged the crowd in San Francisco to tune in and drop out. This meant they should use drugs and leave school or their job. One drug that was used in the 1960s was lysergic acid diethylamide, or LSD. LSD causes the brain to see strange, colorful images. It can also cause brain damage.
Lucy in the sky with diamonds. Lucy in the sky with diamonds.
Some people say the Beatles' song Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds was about LSD.
Well, now take down your fishing pole and meet me at the fishing hole. We may not get a bite all day, but don't you rush away.
As many Americans were listening to songs about drugs and sex, many others were watching television programs with traditional family values. These included The Andy Griffith Show and The Beverly Hillbillies. At the movies, some films captured the rebellious spirit of the times. These included The Graduate and Dr. Strangelove.
Deterrence is the art of producing in the mind of the enemy the fear to attack. And so, because of the automated and irrevocable decision-making process which rules out human meddling, the doomsday machine is terrifying. Yes, it's simple to understand and completely credible and convincing.
Gee, I wish we had one of them doomsday machines.
Other films offered escape through spy adventures like the James Bond films. Many Americans refused to tune in and drop out in the 1960s. They took no part in the social revolution. Instead, they continued leading normal lives of work, family, and home. Others, the activists of American society, were busy fighting for peace and racial and social justice.
I am woman, hear me roar, in numbers too big to ignore, and I know too much to go back and pretend.
Women's groups, for example, were seeking equality with men. They wanted the same chances as men to get a good education and a good job. They also demanded equal pay for equal work. A widely popular book on women in modern America was called The Feminine Mystique. It was written by Betty Friedan and published in 1963. The idea known as the feminine mystique was the traditional idea that women have only one part to play in society. They are to have children and stay at home to raise them. In her book, Ms. Friedan urged women to establish professional lives of their own. In the early 1960s, a committee was appointed to investigate the condition of women. It was led by Eleanor Roosevelt. She was a former First Lady. The committee's findings helped lead to new rules and laws. The 1964 Civil Rights Act guaranteed equal treatment for all groups. This included women. After the law went into effect, however, many activists said it was not being enforced. The National Organization for Women, NOW, was started in an effort to correct the problem. The movement for women's equality was known as the Women's Liberation Movement. Activists were called women's libbers. They called each other sisters. Early activists were usually rich, liberal, white women. Later activists included women of all ages, women of color, rich and poor, educated and uneducated. They acted together to win recognition for the work done by all women in America.
And that's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow to keep learning English through stories from around the world. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak.